it's really easy to be a feminist activist in Iceland right now, because it really feels that everyone is feminist. Like, it's a common that, like, if you're a politician running for office and you claim that you're not feminist, it hurts your chances of election. Men, women, gender neutral people are feminist, because everyone is agreed that gender equality is something that we all strive for.
Velkommen til podcasten Ligestilling Nu. Om strukturer, om køn, om mangfoldighed, om ansvar, om kvindekamp, om ligeværd, kønsroller, sundhed, feminisme, lønkamp, ligeløn, privilegier, sexisme. Ligestilling Nu. En podcast af Line Gæsø.
Thank you very much, Brunhilde, to participate in my podcast about equality. I would love you to introduce yourself. Tell us who you are, what you are, what your profession is.
Okay. Hi. My name is Brunhildur, and thank you for having me on. I am the Secretary General of the Icelandic Women's Rights Association. Ég tala en smá dansk. Ég har lært dansk for mange år í Ísland, men ég ekki svo gott talið en, men ég leser dansk fint. Men når ég talar feminism, så måske skal ég brúa nú engelsk.
We do it in English.
You have to say, you have to give me points for effort of trying to be all inclusive. I have to say, now working in feminism, it's the Nordic cooperation is so important to us here in Iceland, working in feminism. And I often meet and talk, and I love to talk with my Nordic colleagues, because as we know, we in the Nordic countries are so united in the way we work. We see the world and the way we see equality and how we want to focus and organize our societies. And but I found sort of like in my past 10 years in working for the Icelandic women's rights organizations, is that my Danish has become progressively worse. Actually, before I started working for my organization, I had a pretty good, you know, Danish accent. Well, you know, not really good, but, you know, it was passable. I lived for three months in Copenhagen when I was a teenager.
Oh.
Drinking beer, because you could drink beer in Copenhagen when you at the age of 18, which you could not in Iceland. And now I find that I speak sort of like this pan Nordic, this blondinavisk.
Yeah. we just speak in English, and then you don't have to exercise your Danish today.
All right. Anyway, so I work for the Icelandic Women's Rights Association, and we are the oldest feminist organization in Iceland. We were founded in 1907, specifically to work on women's right to vote. But also on the side, I say with air quotes, we were also founded to work to seek equal access for women to the labor market and to education and to public office. And so we received the right to vote in Iceland in 1915, the same year as in Denmark, actually. Iceland at that time was a part of Denmark, but that's a whole another story. but we still haven't achieved the other objectives that the organization was founded, that we have equal status and access to the labor market, to education, and to public office. I mean, the thing is sort of like what we've achieved, obviously, in the past century is that, you know, all the formal hurdles that were in place in the early 20th century have disappeared, right? Like, you know, there is, you have theoretically equal access to all these places, but we have the societal structures. We still haven't finished changing the societal structures. So we see that the status of women in all areas of society is still not equal to the status of men. So we are still needed today, and we're going to be needed for a long time, I fear.
Yeah. And how long have you been working with gender equality?
Well, I started working for the Icelandic Women's Rights Association 10 years ago today. But obviously, I've been involved in the feminist movement for a much longer period. I started by volunteering for a feminist magazine in 1999 in Iceland, and this was a magazine that was published by, it was called Vera, and it was published by the Icelandic Women's List, which was a women's only political party that was actually represented in parliament in between the years 1982 to 2000. And so I started volunteering there. Then I joined, you know, a few, you know, feminist groups, and you know, and so I've always been adjacent to feminist activities until I finally started working in 2011 at the Icelandic Women's Rights Association. And it's such a fantastic job. It's sort of like I'm so lucky and privileged to be in my position, because it's really a dream job. I actually get paid now to do what I've always basically what I've been doing for since I was a teenager, working on women's rights and gender equality. And it's sort of like, it gives me, it's such a fantastic place that I can, my job is a place where I can make a difference. That's sort of like what I say and what I do. It has a chance to change the world. When we think about it, like it's such a crazy position to be in, because Iceland is obviously a microstate. There are incredibly few of us. There are only 360,000 people living here in Iceland. But in the field of gender equality, we have such an outside effect. We have we punch above our weight on internationally, because we have come so far in changing the way our society works that people are now starting to look for us to have a solution. So in fact, for some years now, a large part of my work has actually been communicating with other countries, with activists and with media, to talk about sort of like what it is that we're doing here in Iceland and what has been working and why have we been able to make these very quick and efficient changes and changing our society when other countries perhaps have not. And it's not that sort of like we have all the solutions, we don't, but sort of like I like to think of ourselves, say, a test case. Like it's a sort of like, if it works here in Iceland, there's no reason it's not going to work in other countries. And this is also sort of like, I think the best part about the feminist movement and working in gender equality is that sort of like, this is not a fight, this is not a work that can be done in an isolated manner. Like you can't do it on your own, and you can't do it only working within one country. It has to be done in cooperation with everyone. Like if we manage to get the perfect society in Iceland or the perfect society in Denmark, it wouldn't matter if inequality persists outside our borders, right? It has to be done on a global scale, right? Like we need to change society globally. And this is something that the feminist movement has understood from the very beginning. When we look at the women who started working on this in the 19th century, they did this on a global scale. They formed their own organizations, and they then founded the international organizations. And because in the end, sort of like we don't have all the solutions. We get strength and we get good ideas from other countries, and sort of like we need to find out what works best. And in fact, sort of like when I look at just my own organization, we were founded in 1907 after basically because women from the other Nordic countries were calling on Icelandic women that you need to found an organization working on women's rights in Iceland, because you need to work with us. Like, because at that time the Scandinavian countries were having these large international conferences to talk about how we could sort of like gain voting rights in our respective countries. And so we were born sort of like from a global movement, and we are still a part of a global movement. And you know, and I am hopeful that I'm positive that sort of like we will prevail in the end.
Yes. I mean, this is the reason why I wanted to talk to you, because the World Economic Forum just came with Global Gender Gap Index for 2021. And you are the Iceland is the most gender equal country in the world for the 12th time in a row, I believe. Mm-hmm. And while we are in Denmark, falling from place number 14 to place number 29, I think indeed we can look to Iceland to see what could we do better, what could we try to improve. And of course, most of the world could learn something from it.
I think again that this is the results came out what was it last week, and it wasn't even news in Iceland, and now we're like, oh, again, wait, what? No, but the thing is sort of like, I mean, these numbers are obviously misleading. So I mean, it's. I'm going to begin by talking about, so like if we think about the list, like it doesn't address some issues, like there's no talk about violence in the global gender gap index. So we have to recognize that this list focuses only on specific issues. So it's not sort of like a comprehensive view of the status of equality in Iceland. And even looking at the very narrow fields that the report looks at, I think it says, I mean, we reached, 87% equality? And, you know, yes. 87%, that's not equality, that's inequality, right? So even within the chosen fields, like, we still have not reached parity. And I think sort of like our place at the top of this list says less about how equal and how good things are in Iceland and more about how bad things are in the rest of the world. And that's really concerning to me. And but that being said, there have been some fantastic changes that have taken place in Iceland in the past decades, and especially in the last 10 years, because now I'm speaking on a Nordic level. When you look at the Nordic countries, it used to be, when I was born in the late 70s, Iceland was at the bottom of our five countries in terms of where we are in women's rights and gender equality. All the other, the other four Nordic countries were so much further ahead of us. But now it's sort of like things have changed, and they've changed very rapidly. And I think, I mean, there are, I think I have a pet theory about this. I think I think it's actually thanks to the financial crisis of 2008. And this is my own personal theory. And it's sort of like so what happens, obviously, in 2008, you have a global financial recession. And in Iceland, that was a catastrophic, absolutely catastrophic. Like when we talk about it, we talk about it as hrunið, or the collapse, and with a capitalized H, hrunið. So where were you when the hrunið happened, right? So it's like, I mean, when you and you know, we joke about it now, but we're talking about the bankruptcy of the whole financial system in Iceland, and it's such a severe disruption of society, it will have some effects. We are very, because of the hard work of so many people, of the people who are in government, people in civil society, just and the public in general, we made it so that this financial collapse, it didn't turn out to be a calamity. It didn't actually collapse our social structures, and it didn't collapse our government or governance system or society, frankly, but we used it as a chance to begin reorganizing. What happened after the collapse, I think the public began, there became a public awareness that where things were before was not right. Like in the early 20th, in the late 20th century and early 21st century, we had the sense that, sure, you know, we haven't reached gender equality, but, you know, we're on the way. We don't actually have to do anything special. It will just happen, you know, because there was lots of focus on financial capital and wealth, and there was not really, I think, this general sense of public responsibility or the responsibility of the individual to society. Not a lot of interest in politics, frankly, unless it was on a superficial level. But I mean, obviously what happens in 2008 is that you have our whole community, like our whole society going like, things were not okay. And things like this happened because we were not watching, like we were not involved. Like, so you had like the, I'm not going to say radicalization, I'm going to say the awakening of the population, that it's important to be a part of democracy, and it's important to become active in involved in their local community, rather than just being a passive observer. And I think sort of like, and I think it also it also perhaps gave a chance for the majority of us to sort of like recognize that, okay, what are the political ideologies that we are following, and how do these political ideologies help? And you know what, when you think about like political ideologies in the world, feminism is the best one. Like, feminism is the only political movement that hasn't, you know, killed people or, you know, or caused extermination. Like, if feminism is this sort of like, it's the movement that really just, that is working for equality for everyone. And it's open to sort of like any, lots of local interpretation of feminism. It's just like feminism is working for us all. So, and I think, so that, I think that was a turning point. Like, obviously, obviously, what happened after the financial collapse, the government collapsed, and they called for a snap elections. And for the first time, women broke the glass ceiling in parliament. Sort of like they'd never really gone above 30%, but sort of like in the snap elections of 2009, women went from 30% to 42, and right, like, and we haven't really gone down since. And this was an election where nobody was talking about gender equality. Everyone was talking about money and the IMF or the International Monetary Fund. And they wanted to vote for something new. And you know what was new? Like, who were the people who had not been actively involved in creating the conditions that caused the crash? Women. And in fact, sort of like the Icelandic parliament, 2 years after the, like in 2010, the Icelandic parliament published a huge, huge 9-volume report about why, what caused the financial crash here in Iceland. And a part of that report actually included a gender analysis. And it showed basically that women were, there were no women in the boards or the upper management of the banks or the financial institutions, right? And it basically shows us what happens sort of like, you know, when there is a lack of diversity in the people making decisions in these important places and financial institutions. And it's sort of like, and this is something that's, and this is something that, that, international financial institutions have also found when they do their studies. And Christine Lagarde, in fact, like a couple of years later, then sort of like started talking about gender equality sort of like in the decision making places in financial institutions as being crucial to secure the financial stability of the world. And So basically, with this this crisis came opportunity. New people were elected, and then sort of like what happens is that, you know, new legislation starts appearing, and it's, I think, I sometimes think about it's really easy to be a feminist activist in Iceland right now, because it really feels that everyone is feminist. Like, it's a common that, like, if you're a politician running for office and you claim that you're not feminist, it hurts your chances of election.
Yeah, right?
It's a people are feminist, like the men, women, gender neutral people are feminist, because everyone is agreed that gender equality is something that we all strive for, whether we come on the left or on the right. We have maybe different ways of getting there, but we all agree that gender equality is the end, that the final point, that this is a society that we want to build together. And
So it's a core value. It's a core value in your society.
And it wasn't when I was born. It wasn't when I was growing up. I mean, when I was in the late 20th century. In the late 20th century, I sound ancient. I'm only 42, you know. I was born in 78. But when I was 20, right, like starting out in my feminist groups, and, you know, we, like in 97, 98, you know, feminism was, it was a bad word. Like, you know, people would go like, oh, you're a feminist. That's something radical. Like, what is that? That's sort of like, and I think sort of like, and like, you know, organizations, sort of like they, I think our, like, I was a part of a group that we started in college, and we called ourselves BRI, the Young Feminist Group. And I think we were actually the first registered civil society or NGO that's to actually use the word feminist in our title. Like, before that, everyone else had been using just women, because feminist was such a scary word, right? And now it's been normalized, and it's happened very, very rapidly. And I think I sometimes wonder if it's sort of like when change starts to happen, at some point it becomes unstoppable. I mean, it certainly feels that way to me. Most days is that it's become so, like, we are now changing so rapidly, and every change that we're making is creating a more equal society. And it feels like it's really hard to start. Like, I don't see how we as a society could actually go back. Like, there is no conceivable scenario that I see that Iceland will actually go back to, you know, an earlier place in time. But that being said, I look at the situation where our neighboring countries are, and our neighboring Nordic countries where Denmark is, for example, that there is I should not think that way. That is sort of like, because there is a rising backlash against women's rights and gender equality. There is a rising populist movement that's sweeping the world, we have to be prepared for when it happens to come to Iceland. And in fact, we have been preparing in many ways. So, I mean, some of the things that made us fairly equal in Iceland before was, for example, when you look at abortion legislation, Iceland, it used to have a fairly bad abortion legislation. It was passed in, what, 75, 76. And it basically said that that women seeking an abortion, they needed to get permission from a doctor and a social worker, and or a social worker. And it was sort of like this typical, you know, 1970s sort of like the legislation, sort of like, you know, they didn't really, they were kind of okay that women should get the choice for an abortion, but, you know, they weren't really, you should really have a doctor, male doctor, of course, you know, sign off on it. And when you think of, and like, I mean, and this legislation worked. I mean, it was almost a half century old legislation. And like, there were like nobody, like in the past 20, 30 years, like nobody had ever been denied permission, right? Like, people who had asked for abortion, they got an abortion, period, right? But then we started thinking about, okay, but now we look at the things that are happening in the other countries in Europe. What would happen if we got a government or people in power that actually would say no to a woman asking for an abortion? Like, you know, so we needed to make sure that we passed the legislation enshrining the rights of women over their own bodies, or the rights of people over their own bodies, before that happens, right? Like, so one of the things that we've been focusing on and this is a part of sort of like how we can change our legislation to sort of like to keep adding on sort of like the things that have been sort of like just the norm and making it the law.
Yeah, exactly. What you're saying is really supportive of it. The World Economic Forum, their gender gap index is, of course, about political empowerment, economic participation, pay gaps, and so on. But when we go into the issues about violence against women and as you're saying, abortion, what about then? I mean, in Denmark we had a new rape legislation, or how is it with the consent issues in, but there's also porn and prostitution and so on. How is it in Iceland?
Yeah, I mean, there's still so much work to be done in updating our legislation. For example, I think it was only last year that they added to the penal code a section on stalking. Like, stalking hadn't actually, like, it's just like, it's, I mean, our penal code comes from 1944. So like, it's actually sort of like, and it's just been patchworked and continually updated since then. And so, so there's so much work to be done in sort of like adding those legal tools that we need for the police to actually work on this issue. And when you look at online violence and online stalking spreading of sexualized images of people without their consent, there is no legislation in place. Like, you know, they're working on it, but you know, it's still not been added to the so we still have we still have a long way to go to sort of like, I mean, the thing is like, and it will never be finished. You know, we're always going to be tinkering with the legislation. Legislation is meant to be tinkered with. We keep working to seek perfection, but perfection can never be found because, you know, our understanding of the world changes continually. And in the end, it's sort of like, and it's also sort of like a battle that has to be, and it's not about just the work that has to be done on the legislative level. We also have to focus on who is actually performing these, who is actually operating under these laws. So we have to look at the police system. Like, is the police given enough funding and training to actually work with these laws and to actually support the women who are, or the people who are survivors of sexual violence? Are we looking at how the police is organizing themselves? Like, are there enough women in the police? In Iceland, no. There's a severe lack of women in the police force. It's getting better and rapidly, but you know, we're not we are still not at the place where we want to be. We need to support victim services to help victims of violence, and whether it's gender based or sexual violence, to seek not only to sort of like seek help for themselves, like health and psychological help, but also to seek justice. To how they can navigate the legal system, sort of like that, because in the end we need to create a society where violence against women is actually a crime. And you know, and I say this and it sounds so horrible, but when you think about rape cases in Iceland, as it is in other countries in Europe and Denmark as well, is that rape is in most cases, like when a person rapes, that person is not prosecuted. Like, you know, it's it's 2-3% of like reported rapes that to the police actually end in conviction. So if it's such a low statistic, like, can we call this a crime? Right? Like, really, this is a norm that we have to change. We have to make sure that that rapes are being taken seriously in the criminal justice system in our countries, and to do that, we're going to need so much more money. I mean, like, it sounds facetious, and it sounds sort of like that. But I think in Iceland, you know, we have the police gets maybe what 300 reports of rape every year. It's somewhere around that. I don't have the exact figures. Our prison system houses maybe 200. So imagine if every person who rapes in Iceland is actually sent to jail for a month. We would have to build what? You know, we would have to increase double our prison system, or more than that, to actually sort of like, so we're talking about an epidemic of violence that's happening with impunity in our countries. But this has to obviously and but this the, yeah again I perhaps it's, I'm a hopeful person. This will change as well, because and this change has to happen, and this has to, this area we need to think about it in a holistic manner to also focus on getting women equally represented in legislature and in city councils and local councils, because that's where the money is, right? Like, who are the people who are actually making the decision about our budgets? Those are the people in government. So we need to make sure that sort of like we get women elected into those positions, or people who are care about violence and violence against women, and you know, gender equality in general. So all of this whole sentiment, like, you can't change just focus on one part of society and hopes everything else. Like, you have to work on all of it together.
And
I think sort of like, and of course, and this is against goes back to my point that I was talking about isolation. Like, you can't do this alone. You can't do this in isolation. Like, you know, one organization or, you know, one person in politics or, you know, one party in politics, like, they can't change the system. Like, it has to be done together. And so like, when we think about work on the activist level, like we are, this means that sort of like, we need to have a vibrant feminist movement. Like, we need to have organizations that are working in all areas of society. So you need to have organizations that are working with violence. You need to have organizations that are working in money, organizations that are working on business and then on politics. So like, and we need to make sure that sort of like those organizations are communicating and working together. And I think sort of like, in the end, when we think about why Iceland is where it is today, it's because of a very strong and vibrant feminist movement that works together in consensus. Well, not in consensus, we can never have consensus, but it works together, you know, with a common goal of creating gender equal society. And because in the end, sort of like, you get people into power that are working on gender equality, but that's not enough. You have to always monitor them. You have to have outside pressure groups that are pushing the people in power to do the right thing, to work on. And so that's why the feminist movement is so incredibly important. And when I speak with politicians, I tell them that the best thing that they can do to save our country, to save Iceland, or, you know, that the best thing that they can do is to actually make sure that those organizations are adequately funded. Like, the cheapest way to ensure democracy and the health of democracy in our countries is to fund the organizations that are working on human rights. Because those are these organizations, they provide the absolute, civil society provides the bulwark, the foundation for a healthy democracy. They are the people that are going to be sort of like, you know, they are not only watching and monitoring sort of like the government, but they're also providing these fantastic like services and outreach to people that really need them. So it's incredibly important to make sure that sort of like the funding of civil society is secure, and especially organizations that are working on women's rights, because it's the absolute driver of all progress that we've made in gender equality has been done on the backs of feminist activists for over a century now.
And you are well funded and
I cough. Not as well funded as we would like. I mean, it's sort of like, when you think about it, we have one staff member, and that's me, period. Everything else is done with volunteers. And when you look at this sort of like what our organization is doing, is just like it's ridiculous. It's only been and it's only fairly recently that we managed to sort of like achieve the relations with the government that sort of like we would get a block grant per year to basically just fund operations. For many years, for decades, we had to apply for project grants every year. And when you're applying for a project grant, I mean, it's obviously very important to have project grants, but then it sort of like constrains you to work on these specific projects. And when you're working there, you're trying to find, okay, how can I make this project work for to see if it can help us to maintain our core work. So, but that being said, we are now and have been for the past few years supported by the Icelandic government with a grant, and it's sort of like it's absolutely crucial to allow us to do the work that we need. And this is something that unfortunately not all organizations in Iceland are done that. And I know that other Nordic countries, I know, for example, that Sweden, they have a legislation that I really, this is something that I'm talking about, how can we learn from what other countries are doing. And I know, for example, in Sweden, they have a part of their gender equality legislation. The government there financially supports every organization working on women's rights. And the funding is predicated on the number of members, which means that it's sort of like it's democratically spread, and they have like a criterion who gets funded. But the idea is that everyone has access to this funding. And sort of like, and just a simple fact like this, it's basically the foundation for sort of like a more vibrant feminist work on the activist level. Is that so? This is something that we're still pushing the Icelandic government to sort of like that this is something that they need to do. They have not been willing to listen so far, but you know, we'll keep pushing. And you know, and in the end, sort of like, I think absolutely. So funding is something that we who are working in at the grassroots level, like in the activist level, we don't often talk about it, but it is incredibly important to talk about, like all this work that we're doing to changing the world. Like we're not getting paid for it, and we need to make sure that's sort of like, you know, that we have that we can actually pay for this work. And
Do you have also research in gender equality, because you are doing something right? I mean, the index shows that 12 yeah. years in a row. So mm-hmm. I would think that it would be really interesting to have something, to have researchers looking into what you are doing, what is working, what is not working, mm-hmm. why is it working, and what can we learn from it?
I think obviously there's lots of research that has been done on various aspects of the gender equality work in Iceland, and much of it is available in English. A lot of it is also available in Danish or Swedish, and it's been done, like research has been done and part of the Nordic Council of Ministers. I mean, there is no one magic bullet. It's a series of solutions. It's a patchwork. Like you need to change, you know, many sectors of society. So there are like some keys to the, there are some keys to changing this. So let's, for example, look at the gender pay gap. Like how can we tackle something like the gender pay gap? The gender pay gap in Iceland still persists, and it's still high. And we have several solutions to the problem. But these solutions, like we have a toolbox that with many tools, and each of them is meant to tackle a different aspect of the problem. So, for example, when you look at Iceland, I think sort of like the gender pay gap, when you calculate it on an hourly basis, is maybe around, I don't know, 15% of it on the unexplained gender pay gap. Sort of like economists love to explain away the gender pay gap, and you know, find the unexplainable part as being, you know, oh, it's only 4%, you know, it's barely nothing. No, but the gender pay gap on an hourly basis is 15%. But the figure that I want to focus on when talking about the gender pay gap is when you focus it on the monthly basis, because that's where the things start to happen. The gender pay gap then in Iceland is 25%, and this, of course, reflects the fact that women work shorter hours than men. And they have an average work week of around 36, 37 hours, and men in Iceland have an average work week of 48 hours. And of course, you know, and so, and, you know, and this is not because, you know, women in Iceland are lazy. They're not working such, you know, they're not working, you know, less hours because, you know, they just want to be home and, you know, lie in the sofa and watch Netflix. No.
They do the care work, I guess.
Yeah, they do the care work. They're doing unpaid work at home in society, sort of like taking the burden away from not only sort of like the government offices that could be doing it, but also from, you know, their male partner who is actually, you know, still at work and getting paid for it. And this sort of like, and so, and this sort of like creates, and this, of course, impacts women heavily. Like, not only today, they're taking time off work to do sort of like, it impacts their career trajectory. Like, they progress slower in their careers. It impacts their wages today. It impacts their old age pensions, right? Because they're collecting less money in their pension fund. So it's a so how can we as a society tackle a problem like this? You know, and you know, there are several solutions that we've all begun implementing. You know, number one, very important, it's daycare, right? You need to have universal and affordable daycare. And in fact, I think Denmark is actually doing better than Iceland in daycare. Like, we actually don't have a guaranteed right to daycare. Our daycare system is not legally mandated like in Denmark. It's now is still sort of like a part of the municipal system. So we still have work to do there. But, you know, we have a daycare system. Then we have a parental leave system, and this is incredibly important. Like, you know, the easiest way for a government or a legislature to change social behavior is to change the parental leave system. So we now we have a 12 months of parental leave. 4.5 months are tied to each parent, and then you have actually the way they word it is like, we have a parental leave of 12 months, 6 months to each parent, period. But, you know, then you have the caveat, you have each parent can transfer up to 6 weeks to the other parent. So you have so if one parent, let's say the father, I don't know, let's just give it, let the father sort of say, you know, I'm just going to keep mommy, you know, my 6 weeks, you know, the father will still have to take 4.5 months, and the mother would then get 7.5 months. If the father decides not to take the 4.5 months, the leave just it disappears. It doesn't. It's non-transferable. Period. So, and we started this work around the concept of, like, the first legislation that gave equal parental leave in Iceland was passed in 2000, and it's been absolutely crucial to. To changing the way the new generation looks at family. So, like, it's the young men take more part in that unpaid care work that women have focused on. So then the generations before. So we're still reaping the benefits of it. So there you have two tools in a toolbox to tackle the gender pay gap. Like, none of them. Do the solution, like, they're none of them are the solution, but they're part of the solution. And then we have another aspect of the gender pay gap. So we have this social aspect of women having other obligations and doing more unpaid work. But then we also have, you know, direct discrimination, you know, that unexplained gender pay gap that women just somehow mysteriously get, you know, less money for their work in this company than this their guy that they're working next to. We in Iceland, we passed in 2017 an absolutely unique tool that I called the Equal Pay Standard. The Equal Pay Standard is a human resource management system that sort of like companies can use to basically analyze their payroll. They analyze sort of like the work that is being done or the jobs that are created by, like, being done at the company, how much value and to place value on these jobs, and then analyze sort of like, okay, is that person who is working in that job, is that person being paid fairly for that job? And this standard was introduced in Iceland in 2012, then on an optional basis, sort of like, it was not mandatory. Companies and employers could just like choose to use it, whether like they wanted to or not. But in 2017, it was made mandatory, and now every company or institution with 25 or more employees needs to undergo certification based on this standard. And, you know, it's a revolutionary standard because it basically shifts the burden of proof away from the employee to the employer, right? Because, you know, Iceland passed the first legislation to ban pay discrimination in 1951. Right. It's 70 years ago that like we have banned pay discrimination for 7 years, for 70 years. Yeah. And it's still rampant. Right. Yeah. So and of course, why is it? Because first, as an employee, you number one, you need to figure out that you're being discriminated against. You know, so many countries have pay secrecy. You need to get rid of pay secrecy. But then you need to figure out, okay, am I being discriminated against? But then you need to find the resources to actually do something about it. You need to have, do you have the social resources, like the friends and family that will support you in seeking justice against your employer? Do you have psychological resources to actually undergo the process of actually suing your employer? Do you have the financial resources to seek legal help or to make sure to stop anything from happening? And and if you actually succeed, if you sue your employer and you get and you get some, you get your, and you get, a higher wages or, and you get some money back, right? It's your problem is solved. It doesn't help the woman who is sitting next to you, right? So it's always been, but now in Iceland, it's the companies that have to prove that they are not discriminating. And so that's absolutely crucial. So, but again, it's only a part of the solution. It can't be the whole solution because it only works on a company-wide basis. So, a company can't be paying everyone equally or fairly and equally, but it can't be paying really crappy wages, right? So everyone is being paid equally badly. And now we come to the third and final part of the puzzle of how do you solve the gender pay gap? How do you close the gender pay gap? And that's just, plain old, sexism. It's the plain old fact that we live in a society where women's work is valued less than that male work. So we in Iceland, professions that are heavily dominated by women, nursing or childcare, they are the people that are working in those professions get less money than people that are working in heavily male-dominated professions like construction work or farming or fishing. So even though when you look at, for society, these are equally valuable work for society, but women's work is traditionally less valued. And for that, we need to have grand solutions. And we don't have the solution to that in Iceland. There was a committee. It's in a committee now. We're working on it. No. It was actually, it was a fairly profound last year. The government, the prime ministry, they convened a committee to actually think about this large problem of valuing, of valuing work. How can we, and they're thinking about philosophically, everyone agrees that women's work is equally as important as men's work, but we live in a society where labor agreements and general agreements where we've placed monetary value on this work and women's work is valued less. So how can a government come up with a solution that can help raise it? They formed this committee to think about these big questions and to seek out what are other countries doing? Is there something that the government can do to create the tools? What are some tools that we can use to start to try to tackle that part of the problem? We are a work in progress.
Yeah, but even though you are number one, you are a work in progress. It always is.
No, I think the equal pay standard, I want to say one thing about the equal pay standard because I love talking about the equal pay standard. It's the fact that it's been translated into English and it was written to international standards, really. So it can't be adopted by other countries. And I know that the other Nordic countries are looking at it. Because I mean, in the end, it's a system, right? It's a human resource management system. It's supposed to help. Like, there is nothing to stop Denmark, for example, from adapting or this equal pay standard to the Danish conditions, or to create their own standard, and to offer it as a tool. So companies that want to be socially responsible that can begin implementing it, because in the end, it's a tool for companies. It's a tool. It's a standard, just like the green swan, sort of like that proof, sort of like the Nordic green swan that says, you know, this product is made, you know, in an environmentally responsible way, or like the organic stamps that we buy on other food products. We went all the way. We made it a mandatory standard. I know that most countries would not go that way, or not there yet, but sort of like, you know, there is a tool now available. It should be sort of like, people should start using it in other countries.
I totally agree. I know a little bit about it because I used to work for the Union of the Nurses, and we looked into this this equal pay standard, and it would really be good to adapt it. I would love if you post me a link or something for it, then I would put it in the bottom of the podcast. Because
I will send you a link so that will be available.
Or several links.
Many links. I've actually, so like, because I so believe in this standard, I actually created on my website, sort of like on the website of our organizations, we have a database of information about gender equality in Iceland available in English. Yes. Because of like so and one chapter that are just links and art of reports and articles and videos about the equal pay standard, sort of like that's available in English, because again this is a big part of my job is to sort of like to learn from other countries, and to also make sure that that other countries can learn from what we are doing.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you very, very much. It was very interesting to hear about Iceland and how you almost reached equality, gender equality, or 89% or how much, something like that.
Yeah. So ik en nu men måske i 10 år.
Yeah, but that's so much better than some of the other countries. It will take 200 years or something. I think Denmark is 135 years away from
135. Yeah, I know. Can you imagine? It's just I think the thing is that I want to maybe end with a voice of not of a warning, but of a clarion call of hope for your listeners, and to talk about COVID-19, because obviously the global gender the global gender gap report showed us is that during COVID-19 there's been a global we've slid back horribly. Yeah. Like our progress has not been stopped. It's gone back in most countries around the world, which is absolutely unacceptable. And if we do nothing, it's catastrophic. Like we cannot allow it to happen. However, we can use this as a wake up call to change society. Just as we started progressing in Iceland on gender equality after we had this following the financial collapse, we should think about all of us who care about gender equality, and especially those of us who are working as activists or working in any result. So like, we need to find a way to use the situation, all the new ideas that are bringing up now, or that are becoming common now, to see if we can use this opportunity for change. Yeah. Sort of like, instead of being swept along by the way, we can sort of like rebuild and reorganize society based on sort of like the way that the new ideas that we have learned during the past year. So I think sort of like this is a moment of opportunity today. So we should all of us combined globally should use it. and working also together on a Nordic level, very important.
Yeah, definitely. And I agree with you that we can use this crisis, this COVID crisis, to make some changes, fundamental changes. Thank you very much, Pranila.
Thank you so much.
I enjoyed it very much.
Same here. Thank you.
Ligestilling Nu, en podcast af Line Gæsø. Se mere på Facebook, Instagram eller LinkedIn. Ligestilling Nu.